Robert was beginning a new life. As the director of a weapons laboratory that would integrate the diverse efforts of the far-flung sites of the Manhattan Project and mold them quickly into a usable atomic weapon, he would have to conjure up skills he did not yet have, deal with problems he had never imagined, develop work habits entirely at odds with his previous lifestyle, and adjust to attitudes and modes of behavior, such as security considerations, that were emotionally awkward and alien to his experience. It is not too much of an exaggeration to suggest that in order to succeed, at age 39, Robert Oppenheimer would have to remake a significant part of his personality, if not his intellect, and he was going to have to do all this in short order. Every aspect of his new job was on a fast-track schedule. Very few things, including Oppenheimer's transformation, could meet that impossible schedule, yet it is a measure of his commitment and willpower that he came very close. Robert had often mused about combining his passion for physics with his fierce attraction to the desert high country of New Mexico. Now he had his chance.
On November 16, 1942, he and Edwin McMillan, another Berkeley physicist, accompanied an Army officer, Major John H. Dudley, to Jemez Springs, a deep canyon 40 miles northwest of Santa Fe. After inspecting dozens of potential sites across the American Southwest, Dudley had finally settled on Jemez Springs as a suitable home for the proposed new weapons laboratory.
Oppenheimer remembered it from his horseback trips as a lovely spot and in every way satisfactory.
But when the three men arrived at Jemez Springs, he and McMillan began arguing with Dudley that the snake of land at the bottom of the canyon was too narrow and confined for the town they envisioned building.
Oppenheimer complained that it had no view of the magnificent mountain scenery and that the site's steep canyons would make it nearly impossible to fence in. "We were arguing about this when General Groves showed up," recalled McMillan. Groves took one look at the site and said, "This will never do." When he turned to Oppenheimer and asked if there was something else around that had prospects, Oppie proposed Los Alamos as though it was a brand new idea. "If you go on up the canyon," Oppenheimer told him, "you come out on top of the mesa and there's a boys' school there which might be a usable site." Reluctantly, the men piled back into their cars and drove northwest about 30 miles across a lava mesa called the Pajarito, Little Bird, Plateau. It was already late afternoon when they pulled up to the Los Alamos Ranch School. Through the haze of drizzly snowfall, Oppenheimer, Groves, and McMillan saw a group of schoolboys out on a playing field running around in shorts. The school's 800-acre grounds included the Big House, its main building, Fuller Lodge, a beautiful manor house built in 1928 from 800 huge ponderosa logs, a rustic dormitory, and a few other smaller buildings. Behind the lodge, there was a pond that the boys used for ice skating in the winter and canoeing during the summer. The school stood at an elevation of 7,200 feet, just about at timberline.
To the west, the snow-capped Jemez Mountains rose to 11,000 feet.
From the spacious porch of Fuller Lodge, one could look 40 miles east across the Rio Grande Valley to Oppenheimer's beloved Sangre de Cristo mountain range, rising to a height of 13,000 feet. By one account, as Groves surveyed the scene, he suddenly announced, "This is the place!" Within 2 days, the Army initiated the paperwork to buy the school, and 4 days later, after a quick trip to Washington, D.C., Oppenheimer returned with McMillan and Ernest Lawrence to inspect what had been designated Site Y. Wearing cowboy boots, Oppenheimer took Lawrence on a tour of the school buildings. For security purposes, they had introduced themselves under assumed names. But a Los Alamos student, Sterling Colgate, recognized the scientist. "Suddenly we knew the war had arrived here," Colgate recalled. "These two characters showed up, Mr. Smith and Mr. Jones, one wearing a pork pie hat and the other a normal hat, and these two guys went around as if they owned the place." Colgate, a high school senior, had studied physics and he had seen photographs of Oppenheimer and Lawrence in a textbook. Soon afterwards, an armada of bulldozers and construction crews invaded the school grounds. Oppenheimer, of course, knew Los Alamos well. Perro Caliente was a 40-mile horseback ride across the plateau.
He and his brother had explored the Jemez Mountains on horseback over many summers.
Oppenheimer got what he wanted, a spectacular view of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, and General Groves got a sight so isolated there was only a winding gravel road and one phone line into the place. Over the next 3 months, construction crews built cheap barracks with shingled or tin roofs. Similar buildings were constructed to serve as crude chemistry and physics laboratories. Everything was painted army green. Oppenheimer seemed unaware of the utter chaos that had descended on Los Alamos, although years later he confessed, "I am responsible for ruining a beautiful place." Focused on recruiting the scientists he needed for the project, he had no time for the administrative tasks associated with building a small town. John Manley, an experimental physicist whom Oppie had tapped as one of his assistants, had serious qualms about the site. Manley had just come from Chicago, where on December 2, 1942, the Italian émigré physicist Enrico Fermi had led a team that conducted the world's first controlled nuclear chain reaction. Chicago was a big city, home to an eminent university, world-class libraries, and a large pool of experienced machinists, glassblowers, engineers, and other technicians. Los Alamos had nothing. "What we were trying to do," wrote Manley, "was build a new laboratory in the wilds of New Mexico with no initial equipment except the library of Horatio Alger books, or whatever it was that those boys in the ranch school read, and the pack equipment that they used to go horseback riding, none of which helped us very much in getting neutron-producing accelerators." Manley thought that if Oppenheimer had been an experimental physicist, he would have understood that experimental physics is really 90% plumbing. And he never would have agreed to having a laboratory built in such a setting. The logistics were horrendously complicated. Oppenheimer and the initial group of scientists planned to arrive at Los Alamos by mid-March 1943. By then, Robert assured Hans Bethe, there would be a viable community run by a city engineer. There would be bachelor quarters and homes for families with 1, 2, and 3 bedrooms. These furnished quarters would all come with electricity, but for security reasons, there would be no phones. The kitchens would be equipped with wood fire stoves and hot water heaters. There would be fireplaces and a refrigerator. Servants would be available on occasion for any heavy housework. There would be a school for young children, a library, a laundry, a hospital, and garbage collection. An army post exchange would serve as the community's grocery store and mail order house. A recreation officer would arrange for regular movies and hiking trips in the nearby mountains. And Oppie promised there would be a cantina for beer, cokes, and light lunches, a regular mess hall for unmarried people, and a fancy cafe where married couples could eat out in the evening.